Welcome to LOL Adulthood.
Alright, welcome back. I'm your host, Reem, and you're listening to
LOL Adulthood.
Thank you, Michael. Today, what are we talking about, Mike?
So, we're talking about death meditation.
Ooh. Yeah, we're talking...
And... I'm so caffeinated right now.
Literally, Michael had so much to drink.
Not alcohol. Tea.
Yeah, he's loaded up on black tea and Turkish coffee, and now he's chowing down on some lemon Lays, and he's a hot mess.
Oh, yeah, I'm losing it.
He's not getting the cues, and it's disrespectful.
Sorry that you feel disrespected, bitch. I'm sorry.
Anyways... Today, we're going to be talking about a handful of things. We'll be talking about our relation to life as humans and the way we perceive the world.
Yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, so it's really exciting. This year has kind of been a theme of figuring out who we are as people and our placement on this planet and how we all came into existence, essentially. You know, just trying to navigate our way through the concept of free will, existential, I can't even say that word.
Existential?
Existentialism, nihilism.
I mean, that's pretty, if you want to go that route, you can. That's depressing, though.
So, Michael, just, you know, try not to eat too many Lays during this episode.
Just to make use of this last mouthful of Lays that I'm about to eat, we'll provide some ASMR for you guys, all right? So here, let me Just wait, hold that thought. Get ready. Alright. ASMR Lays edition. I'm all weird.
He is definitely weird. He's the weirdest person I know.
That's your opinion.
Anyways, let's dive deep into this conversation, shall we?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. To start off, who should go first?
Well, what are you talking about?
So, I'm going to talk about djinns, golems, and pretas. Ooh. And supernatural demons we find in, I guess, modern society and religion.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I'm talking about death meditation.
Okay.
Which, yeah, I already said that, but I guess maybe we can kind of jump back and forth, yeah?
Yeah, and I mean, yours focuses a lot on impermanence, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Which, Hungry Ghost is kind of that, so. Maybe, okay. Maybe after you talk about pretas, you can, I can jump into that.
Okay, yeah. So, I guess I will start off first then.
Yeah, send it.
Okay. If you've ever tried to revisit the Bible or any spiritual religious text, it's kind of hard to interpret, right? It's kind of hard to relate to and find a connection because it's so, I don't know.
Archaic.
Yeah, it's very archaic and super intense and you're like, bruh. How did people freaking believe any of this stuff?
Yeah, I definitely feel that way.
I definitely felt that way too. And as I was researching, I kind of realized these texts that people created were a way for them to connect with their environment and get a better understanding of the world around them.
Like they were using them to better understand life. Mm-hmm. Is that what you mean? Yeah. Like they were tools.
Yeah, and that's why I thought it'd be cool to talk about djinns, golems, and pretas. So, What are djinns, what are golems, and what are pretas? Well, djinns, if you've listened to previous episodes, they are pretty much elemental beings made out of smokeless fire. This is a prominent belief in Islamic culture that djinns are the second creation God made. So there's God, then there's jinns, and then there's humans. So jinns typically exist on a spectrum, with some being down the mischievous end, while some others occupy a darker and threatening space in the Muslim psyche.
So some are more like tricksters, and then other ones are more like demons.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, and they're just like people. There's really bad ones, there's really good ones, but we can't see them. They live in a different realm than us. We have a veil on, so we can't see them.
So jinns are these beings that God created. They are made of a different matter than humans.
Yes.
Humans are made of earth, right? In the Quran?
Yeah, they're made of clay.
So what are jinns made out of?
Smokeless fire.
So God made them out of fire, then?
Smokeless fire.
Smokeless fire. Mm-hmm. And because we have a veil over our eyes, we can't see their dimension, basically?
Yeah. But they live amongst us.
And can they see us?
Yes.
So they're observing us, and we can't see them.
Yeah.
So they're kind of like ghosts, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
But ghosts that can do shit.
Yeah.
That's what jinns are.
Well, ghosts can do shit, too.
Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah, they can. Have you not seen The Exorcist? Have you not seen The Haunting of Bly Manor?
No, actually, I haven't seen either of those movies.
Anyways, ghosts can do shit, so your statement's invalid. Anyways!
What if they're just djinns pretending to be ghosts? That's a potential.
Just stop talking.
Okay.
Just stop talking. Anyway, so that's what a djinn is. Okay? And then, what's a golem? So a golem is a man-made figure made from clay that is then animated to life to protect the Jewish people. And often when it comes to protection, they do it violently, but sometimes they go a bit crazy and they go on a murderous rampage.
Oh, shit.
Mm-hmm, so that's kind of not good.
So they just start killing everything in sight.
Yeah. A golem is typically brought to life when a rabbi versed in the, quote, secrets of creation, writes down three letters on the clay figure's forehead or on a piece of paper and then slips the paper inside the clay figure's mouth. And on the paper, the word he spells on there is Emet, E-M-E-T, which is the Hebrew word for truth.
Whoa.
And if you were to erase the first letter of that word, E, the word would change to Met, M-E-T, which means death.
Is that how you get rid of the golem?
Mm-hmm.
So you bring it to life by writing the Hebrew... So they're not English letters. Let's clarify that. They're Hebrew letters, right?
Yeah, so E-M-E-T.
So they're letters for E-M-E-T.
Yeah.
And then if you erase one of those Hebrew letters, it turns into the Hebrew word met, meaning death.
Yes.
So emet is truth, met is death.
Yes. Okay. And then, yeah. So Pretas, a.k.a. hungry ghost, is Sanskrit name for a supernatural being described in Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, Chinese folk, Burmese folk religion. And these beings are focused on pretty much suffering greater than that of a human, particularly an extreme level of hunger and thirst. So, okay, let me make this make sense. So, Pretas are pretty much a ghost that is constantly hungry, right? And his hunger or their hunger is always in it. An extreme form. And this belief is found across in Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, Chinese folk, and Vietnamese folk religion.
Okay, but why are they so hungry?
The reason they're hungry is this is the belief, okay? So they are in a transition state between death and obtaining karmic reincarnation in accordance with a person's fate. So they are hungry because they are believed to have been in the in their previous life, they were supposed to be, like, very corrupted, compulsive, greedy people. And as a result of their karma, they're afflicted with an insatiable hunger. Traditionally, this hunger is also very gross. Like, they're hungry for really gross things. So it's believed to be, like, cadavers and feces and stuff. Like, something just super bizarre.
Oh, so they have to eat that when they're in the afterlife?
Yeah, so that's what their hunger is for. So because they were such a shitty person in their human life, as a hungry ghost, they're so hungry, they only eat the grossest things.
Okay.
It's something that's very humiliating. Something very, like, because you were such a bad person, you're going to be hungry in your afterlife. And you're going to be so hungry that the things you're hungry for are going to be very repugnant, very dirty, disgusting, and foul.
Okay. Well, they're... It's not from being a bad person, I thought. It's from just being so attached to the worldly things. It's not like you're an evil person. It's like you're just really greedy.
Yeah, so I'm not saying you're evil. I'm saying if you were just... It's your karma catching up with you.
Yeah.
Okay, so according to the articles I was reading, it's if you were, like, compulsive, if you were living, like, a false life, you were very corrupted, greedy, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So, something that I read in the article that really caught my eye was that these hungry ghosts live in the same physical space as people. And the example they gave of how a preta visualizes the world around them is like this. So, imagine you're in a forest and you see a river.
Yeah.
And as you're seeing a river, you see it being serene, beautiful, scenic, clean, right?
Yeah.
But if a preta was to see it, they said they would be seeing it filled with pus and filth.
Why?
Because they are cursed with having really awful visions all the time.
Why?
That's just what the article said that I read, because of their past.
Oh, interesting.
And then, in order to get out of this, the hungry ghost's family would have to perform rituals to cure them in the afterlife.
And they would be reborn again?
Yes.
So they would go back into reincarnation then?
Mm-hmm.
So... Basically, if they were very attached to things, like they were seeking money or food or things in their normal life, their karma, because of all those attachments, would catch up with them in the afterlife, and they wouldn't be able to be reborn until they get rid of their insatiable hunger through their family saving them through rituals. Is that right?
Yeah.
And then their hunger goes away, and they're reborn to try again.
Mm-hmm. So, again, this whole belief of pritas is based on actions and how your actions have karmic consequences. You get what you set in motion, even if you don't remember doing it. And if you wanted to know what a prita looked like, they are freaking... They have mummified skin. Sunken skulls. They have a very long neck. They said it about the width of a grain of rice.
That's how wide their neck is?
Yeah, and it's super long. Like a giraffe. And then they have a very big belly. And then very long skinny legs and long skinny arms. And they say that their appearance is a metaphor for the mental situation. So their appearance is a metaphor for what these people believe in. So the pritas, they have enormous appetites, right?
Yeah.
Insatiable. So that's why they have a big belly. But then they have a long neck because it's... to signify that even though they have a big belly, they're never going to be satisfied because it takes so long to go down.
Oh, yeah, that's a good metaphor, yeah. So, like, they have a huge hunger, but an inability to fulfill that hunger because of their long, skinny neck.
Yes. So that's a Pritha. So all three of these supernatural beings, jinns, golems, and Prithas,
yeah.
You might know them if you are Muslim, Jewish, or of an Eastern faith. So what I wanted to say was, thinking about these supernatural beings is kind of like, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard to kind of believe, like, these type of creatures exist in our reality, right?
Yeah, first glance, yeah.
And I was thinking, I was like, this whole belief system of connecting the supernatural to religion and then to spirituality in a way lays bare our most cherished ideas around impermanence, memory, and imperfection.
Yeah.
Their existence allows us to understand the world better.
Yeah, how so?
Well, with the jinn, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. The jinn represents an understanding that there's something bigger than us out there. Not just the transcendence in the form of God, but present in nature. Because jinns are actually, where do they live usually? They're usually tied to historical ruins, forests, valleys, rivers. And they're even embodied as, like, dust devils in the desert.
Oh, no way. Mm-hmm. Dust devils are maybe jinns, huh?
Yeah, like, in a way of understanding the world as alive. So, with having jinns emplaced in this religion and this culture and this society, it's a way of understanding the world as alive, not just mechanistic.
So, like, it's a way for you to look out into nature and see things not just as, like, like, you look at a dust devil and you say, oh, that's not just dust swirling around in wind. You're saying, oh, maybe that's alive. Maybe there's a spirit in that, like a jinn.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a way to sort of connect to nature in that way. Like, there's more than meets the eye.
Yes.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The reason golems exist is because there was a time where the Jewish people were really being affected by their environment and society.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That was in between World War I and World War II.
Yeah.
There was a lot of dislocation, a lot of crisis. There was a lot of pain and suffering going on. So in order to cope with their environment and what was going on, they had to create a creature that could help them feel safe and protected and help nurture the younger generations. So they created a golem.
A golem, yeah.
And a golem, in a way, symbolizes humans, man. Because they're made of clay, just like how we were created.
Yeah, in biblical terms, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
So with the creation of the golem, you can see a lot of connections between their relation to their environment and the political atmosphere at the time. And how they wanted to, I guess, protect their community and their culture.
Yeah, so you're saying, like, the concept of a golem was, like, sort of a way for them to feel safe.
Yeah, it was a way to cope with what was going around at that time.
Yeah.
So, according to this professor at Penn State, he was saying a golem represents more than just mysticism. It represented the Jewish experience during that time. Overwhelmingly dislocation and crisis.
Yeah.
Because it was a way for them to not only connect with healing, but it was a way for them to ensure that the kids around them and their community also felt safe during the circumstances. And they even said the golem figure itself represented an immigrant. Because he was made of clay and, according to their folklore, can travel from one country to another rather quickly, just like an immigrant. So the golem symbolized much more than just, like, destroying people and defending a family or property.
Yeah.
The golem represented power and healing in a way.
Yeah. Like they're connecting to their roots as creations of God that are sort of just being thrown around in this like crazy chaotic world.
Mm-hmm.
Well, going from place to place, being fragile, made of clay, you know, but still maybe connected to their source.
Exactly.
God.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then with Preetas, it's highly focused on reincarnation and taking initiative and leading a meaningful life. Right.
A life free of attachment.
Right? A life free of attachment, yeah. You can go more into that because you study more about the Buddhist aspect of this, right?
Yeah, totally.
But yeah, Preetas pretty much... The take on Preetas is that if you squander the life you have, you're likely going to spend a long, long time suffering before you're put back into it again. So they're like... Take advantage now. That is essentially the moral of Preetas.
Like, live in the moment, you know, focus on the things that are important instead of seeking more.
Yes.
Seeking more money, food, right?
Because
that greed may, in their folklore, that greed might carry over and keep you from progressing.
Because
you'll still be hungry for more and more and more.
Yeah, and I wrote this down. I thought it was a cool note that people have interpreted when it comes to believing in Preetas. They say that nothing is forever in Buddhism. Heaven isn't forever. Hell isn't forever. A Preeta existence isn't forever. And neither is a human's life.
Everything's impermanent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really like... hearing about those ancient things, and you know, part of me, like, obviously I'm in psychology, so it's very scientific, focused on what we can experience directly through science, right? But you know, part of me wants to believe in these things. Part of me likes to hear these stories and think, you know, what if someone knew, like a golem, right? What if someone had such knowledge of how the world worked that they could actually imbue something with life? Right? Or what if there really are beings that we can't see, like djinns? You know, it makes me, you know, it's just cool to think about, so. And surely there's a lot about life we don't understand, so, you know, who knows what's out there?
Mm-hmm.
I like to keep an open mind about that. Anyway, yeah, we ended off your conversation with impermanence. Preetas are just kind of a symbol of impermanence, huh?
Yeah.
They're just sort of these beings that have been so attached to, like, hunger or, like, so attached to getting things in their life that they're sort of cursed with always seeking and never getting.
Yeah, that's a great way of saying that.
So that's pretty cool, yeah. And anyway, since that is sort of an Eastern term, this transitions great into what I'm talking about with it, which is Buddhist death meditation. So... Buddhist death meditation is sort of this practice that, you know, Buddhists do to accept their own death and to live life to the fullest. Before we get into that, I'll talk a little bit about how death is perceived in the West, in like Judeo-Christian culture, right? And kind of the culture we're surrounded by most of the time in America. Right? If you've ever been to a funeral, which I'm sure most of you guys have, you know, to the viewing ceremony... Usually you see this sort of embalmed body. They've taken out all the organs. They've put, you know, formaldehyde and stuff to make sure the body doesn't decompose naturally. And then they put makeup all over this body, right? So you see this sort of dolled up version of the body. And this kind of harkens back to, like, the Christian belief that, like, you know, you might be dead, but you're going to heaven. Right, you're gonna get your body in the afterlife. You're gonna be resurrected, and so your body is still yours. Like, you're holding on to this body, and so they sort of try to symbolize that by sort of dolling up and making this body almost look lifelike, even though it's dead. It's like almost kind of in a sense, sort of a denial of death as something that's just temporary and, you know, in the end, you'll still have your body that you had in your normal life, right? It's kind of how Christians see things. You know, the statement, my body is a temple, is a huge thing in Utah. Mormon culture, you know, Christian culture. And again, like, it's sort of the belief that death is more or less an illusion. You know, you might die in this physical realm, but you'll still get your body that you have now in the afterlife. And so, really, it doesn't... Real death isn't a thing for Christians. And that's why maybe they hold on to wanting to make this body look perfect in the viewing ceremonies, right? Anyway, so why is this such a thing in our culture? And what are its effects on the mind? Well, there's evidence from psychological studies that people use society and religion to cope with fears of death. And this is called terror management theory, TMT. And this kind of proposes that people use society as a buffer against death anxiety, right? We are animals, we're afraid to die, right? That's natural in us. And so we use things like keeping people close. We use things like religion to sort of alleviate that anxiety. And there's evidence that people emphasize like group cohesion and rather than individuality when they're threatened by thoughts of death. So that means if people are afraid of dying, they tend to cluster in groups rather than do things on their own, because it helps, you know, get rid of that death anxiety. And interestingly, there's a really cool example of this. So it's been found in studies that in humid, pathogen-rich environments in the world, like in like southern China, right, super moist, or Vietnam, like, you know, super... They're like tropical environments where there's tons of moisture, tons of bugs, tons of diseases. In these places in the world, they're more likely to be collectivist and emphasize conformity rather than in dry areas in the world, they emphasize more individuality and less conformity.
Interesting.
Right? So like...
What does that mean?
So that means in places where there's a lot of threat that you're going to die early, like there's a lot of diseases, there's a lot of things that are threatening your life, the society living in that area is more likely to be conformist and collectivist, like communism, rather than more individualistic, like you make your own life, you know, it doesn't matter about everyone else, you do your thing. We might see more individualistic sort of ways of life in like drier areas, right? Areas where you're not as likely to get a disease that will kill you. And so going back to TMT, this is because when people are afraid of dying, they form groups, right? They seek collective attention rather than doing things on their own. So we can see that clearly. And it's true that in China, in areas in the East where there is more danger of getting a tropical disease, they are more collectivist. They're less individualistic. Mm-hmm. Whereas in America, it is mostly drier over there, especially in the West. And, you know, what's the symbol of the West?
Independent.
Lone gunslingers, man. Freaking cowboys. You know, doing their own thing, riding alone into the desert, into the sunset, you know?
It's true. I've never really thought of it that way.
Yeah. If the desert was full of pathogen-causing bacteria and viruses, well, then maybe the Wild West would be a symbol of communism. Or, you know, like it might be different. And so it's sort of interesting. Anyway, so there have been further studies about what happens when people get anxious about death. And usually what happens when people get anxious about death is there is, you know, like I said, more group cohesion. So people like tend to cluster more in groups and think less individualistically. Also, people are more brutal towards outgroups. So they form their group, their tribe, right? And all outgroups, they sort of push away and they're not as accepting of outgroups, right? So we can definitely see examples of that in the world, too. How people that feel like they're in danger, they're more tribalistic. And maybe even more, like, racist or, like, unforgiving of out-groups. So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And maybe that is sort of the origin of these super intolerant societies, right? Whether they're racist or prejudiced or, like, they're very unaccepting of outside opinions. Sort of maybe the animalistic origin of that behavior is because there's a lot of threats to their safety. And so because of that death anxiety, you know, that threat to safety, they're less accepting of new ideas and more group tribal oriented. It makes sense from an animal perspective why people might act that way. So I just kind of laid out some examples of how people react when they're anxious about death. In brief, you know, when people get anxious that there's a threat to their safety, they cling to their groups, what they know, right? They cling to less of an individual identity and more to a group identity. And they're less open to people that don't think like them, people that aren't in their group. Maybe people of other races, people of other religions, people of other ways of life. When there's a threat to their life, there's a threat of death, they're probably less likely to be accepting of them. So that's like normal, maybe not normal, but like that's basic human behavior. Someone that's not very in tune with themselves, they might kind of revert back to those animalistic tendencies. However, people that do practice meditation and do practice mindfulness, they're sort of able to, like, you know, they're able to find ways not to do those behaviors.
Okay, so you're saying the reason people are so shitty sometimes is because when you boil it all down, it's because they're scared of dying.
Yeah, that's probably a big reason behind a lot of the things that people do, you know? A lot of the boundaries that people place between them and other people, the distinctions they make, like us versus them, a lot of it probably does boil down to sort of a innate fear of impermanence, that, you know, of not having stability, mm-hmm. sort of an animal fear of, yeah, dying in a sense. It's like a way to cope with the threat that I might not last forever. That might be a huge reason why people make stories, like you talked about. Make legends, have religions so that they have a way of coping with instability. Mm-hmm. The natural instability of life. And death is like the biggest instability of all, because
nobody knows.
Nobody can predict it. There's a lot of threats. And when you die, you know, your body, your genes, they go away. And so there's probably a lot, yeah, that's probably a big reason why there's so much division in our world, is a lot of people are still very much trying to avoid the feelings of their anxiety about death. So it's pretty eye-opening when you think about it. And from a Buddhist perspective, this is because a lot of people are still very attached to the world. They're unable to be mindful with their feelings, and they just try to avoid them. They're trying to avoid their fear of death by coping in all these elaborate ways. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, conforming to a religion, conforming to a people, a country, a race, a way of life. They're defining themselves through all these different groups to cope with their insecurity about instability, which harkens back to our ancestors' fear of death, right? But from a Buddhist perspective, you don't have to stay that way. You don't have to live that way forever, you know? They're like, yo, dude, you can be free. You just have to really look deeply about why you feel this way. And so they have a method of doing this, and that's death meditation.
Oh, okay. So what does death meditation mean? What does it entail?
Well, death meditation is... it's meditating about death, right? In short. Basically, so here's actually a great story that I read about this. So this is from a monk that lived in Thailand, right? One day, this young man who was in his 40s, he was in good health, he was married with three children, and he was like a good person, right? Unexpectedly, a man on a motorcycle came up and shot him in the chest with a shotgun and just killed him for no reason. And he died very suddenly and unpredictably. So this happened in Thailand, right? This monk that was in the area, he heard that this happened, and he went to the village. And all these villagers were scared, and they were saying, you know, we want to get his body out of here as quick as possible because, like, he might come back as a ghost and haunt us. And so we need, because he died so unexpectedly, he might seek vengeance or, you know, cause problems. And so, like, just take his body, get him out of here. So these monks, they took this guy's body, and very unlike the villagers, they were like, yo, this is a dope chance to meditate about the impermanence of life. And so they went and buried this body in a very shallow grave in the ground, in a coffin with an easily removable lid. And this was very near their monastery, so they kept him close to the monastery. And then they hacked a trail through the forest, and they, you know, kind of leveled out a little area of earth. And these monks went and would meditate next to the body as it decomposed. And they used this as a way to meditate over death and about the impermanence of life. The fact that everything changes, that we will change. Someday we all will die and pass on. So they basically use this as an opportunity.
Yeah.
Not to like avoid death, but to embrace death. So, this is what they say about death meditation. This is from a monk that wrote this. He says, this mindfulness of death, which is called Maranasati. This mindfulness of death increases appreciation for the finite human experience and decreases attachment to salient states such as beauty and youth. So basically, these monks are able to use this death meditation to realize what things are important in life. They're able to focus less on things like looking good, or having a lot of money, or having nice experiences all the time, chasing pleasure, right? Because all of those things maybe distract you from the true purpose of life, which is to, you know, be in the moment, be in the now. Just like the hungry ghost, right? These are people that always chase things their whole lives, and then in their afterlife, they kept chasing things, and they were never satisfied. They're never able to rest. And so death meditation basically would be a way to prevent that. To prevent living a life where you're always chasing things like beauty and youth and money. It's a way to look at death as a symbol that things are always changing. And you can never hold on to anything. Right? No matter how much money you make, when you die, you can't take it with you. No matter how youthful you are, beautiful you are, your looks are gonna fade, and you're gonna look all crusty when you're older, no matter what. Everyone is. And so holding on to those things just basically keeps us in a cage and allows us not to experience the present moment. And so using death meditation is a way to sort of let go of those things.
Interesting. You know, this makes me think. And I'm just thinking right now about how if the way this is all sounding, it sounds like after we die, there is a place we go to, like our consciousness goes to, right? Whether that's, I don't know, heaven, hell, or there's a different place we go to because we are more than just people right now.
Like, we have a soul, a spirit.
Yeah, our spirit, our soul, our consciousness. Mm-hmm. This, whatever this energy is. And if, just like the Buddhists, if we dedicate our human life to connect with that spirit, when we die, we're like, oh yeah, we're the spirit.
Not the body.
Oh wow, cool. That sounds pretty, like, it's like, I don't know if I'm explaining this right.
Yeah.
But what it feels like is, like, I'm thinking of this like a video game. we're people right now. This is a video game. We're playing as people, doing our thing. Mm. And then when we die, our soul goes somewhere to who knows where. And then we're like, oh, hello guys, welcome. I sent you guys to Earth to experience human life. And you were supposed to do this and this and this to experience that. Work through anxiety. Deal with depression. Try to balance meaning and being human. But then, like, in Buddhism, or if you're in any spiritual, like, religion or anything like that, it's like you're dedicating the whole video game experience to being a spirit, essentially, or connecting with your spirit. When, at the end of the day, you're going to be a spirit anyways, so why are you so focused on being a spirit? Because you're only here as a human for a minute. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
So what you're saying is, like, if life was a video game, why not have some fun instead of, like, thinking deeply the whole time about, like, no, I shouldn't pursue all these pleasurable things. I should just meditate all the time and be connected to your spirit. Is that right?
Yeah.
You're like, girl, I want to go eat some fucking cheeseburgers and snort coke. Off some strippers' assholes.
I don't know about the strippers' assholes, but coke does sound fun. Just kidding.
Yeah, but you're supporting the cartels, you fuckers. Any of you that snort coke, you should feel bad about yourself.
Anyways, I'm just saying, it kind of sounds like a buzzkill.
That's a great segue into me proving you wrong. Because actually, what death meditation teaches us, right, is that everything changes. Everything is impermanent, right? And not to get attached to things that are, like, pleasurable. So that doesn't mean we can't do pleasurable things or seek things or want things. It doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean we have to, like, fucking sit next to dead bodies our whole lives and meditate over, you know, the meaning of life. No, we can be fully human and still be unattached to things. That means we're allowing everything to take its natural course. When we feel happy and jazzed and fucking, you know, let's go party, hustlers, you know, when we're in that mood, if we realize impermanence that everything changes, we realize that, you know, this happiness will only last so long. And so we don't try to hold on to it. We just allow it to go its natural way. When we don't feel as jazzed anymore, we're okay with that. We allow ourselves to just feel everything and then we let everything go. Also, conversely, if we feel really shitty and depressed and fucked up, then we also allow that to go too. We say, you know, we feel this way right now, but it'll change. And because we realize impermanence, we're able to let that go. And it's easier to feel happy again because of that. Because we're not attached to how we feel. We're not trying to avoid sadness. We're not trying to hold on to happiness. We're just being in the moment with everything that happens. And so you can still have fun. You can still go out and eat cheeseburgers and snort cocaine off hookers' buttholes. Maybe you should cut that out. You know, we can still have a good time. But when those good times end, we allow them to pass. And because of that, we're never holding on to anything. We're just being fully human all the time. That's probably what a Buddhist would say. So it's not that you're living your whole life, you know, being bored as hell. It's that you're really living your whole life. Here's a quote about death meditation that might sort of explain it better than me. So this guy says, in learning more about death awareness meditation, we can learn how to shine the light of death on life. It's not meant to be an exercise in morbidity or self-pity or in terrorizing ourselves. So it's not for, like, being scared shitless of death all the time, or like being like, oh, everything is impermanent, so I should be sad all the time. It's not like that. In fact, one often feels light, happy, and unburdened after directly acknowledging the truth of our inevitable death. One way in which it is extremely invaluable is that it flushes out fear. It gives us an opportunity to work very carefully with fear. Now remember, what we're afraid of is not really death, but our idea of death. And this is one of the things to learn, that it's a very powerful idea. So, in doing something like death meditation, we don't just start to realize our ideas about death. We don't just start to realize what we're afraid of about dying. We start to realize all our beliefs that are attached to this, right? So maybe in realizing that everything is impermanent through a death meditation, we also start to question our other beliefs. Like, am I holding on too tight to my ideas about religion? Or am I holding on too tight about my ideas about who I am as an individual? Or, you know, what are the other things I'm holding on to define myself? And then why am I doing that? That's the question, right? Why do I have these beliefs? Why do I, you know, why am I in this religion? Why am I in this relationship? Why do I consider myself to be this type of person? Is it because you really are? Or is it because you're holding on to that idea to cope with something, right? So it kind of goes with what you're saying. You know, for much of human history, humans have been finding ways to cope with the reality that they're going to die someday, that things are unstable and confusing and weird. And so they need to create stories for themselves to feel more secure, right? But, you know, we don't always have to live that way. These stories are great and they're interesting and they're beautiful, right? You can still be religious. You can still, you know, like learn about jinns and golems and maybe even believe in them. However, at the same time, realize that these things are not meant to be held on to too tightly, because everything will change, you know? And that's the most important thing to realize, is that everything is impermanent. And so instead of defining ourselves by ideas we make, let's define ourselves by living the best life we can in the moment. That should be the primary goal. Not living a certain way, not believing a certain way, but just living. And whatever way we can do that the best, that's what we should do.
I think that was very well said. I feel like, yeah, at the end of the day, it's all about having that human experience. Mm-hmm. Taking things in as they go and not holding on to them.
Mm-hmm.
I think connecting death meditation to the way people pursue their reality through religion and spirituality really shows how we as humans want to find meaning and purpose when it comes to our existence.
Mm-hmm.
We really need something to explain why we're here and how to observe it all.
Yeah.
You know? So I think it's really interesting to think about, like, how we have these supernatural beings and how these biblical stories make us feel and how they really drive how we live our lives.
Mm-hmm. I hear that, yeah.
But yeah, so that's impermanence and thinking about the human connection to the beliefs that we've created throughout time.
Yeah, good shit.
Good shit.
Yeah, bro. I feel like I had a caffeine crash right in the middle of making that podcast.
Yeah, so for you guys, there's a lot that's going to be cut out. You don't know it yet.
Yeah, bro. You listen to this and being like, oh man, that's a smooth as hell podcast, but...
No, we've taken out a shit ton. Probably an hour's worth of audio.
Fucking mindless rambles.
Anyways, thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week. Mm-hmm.